So, imagine walking up to a bank teller, right? And before they even ask for your ID or before you say a single word or hand over your account number, they just reach right across the counter and rob you.
Ha, yes, just immediately on site.
Right. And that completely backwards, terrifying scenario is exactly what is happening across the internet right now. So, welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, we have a massive stack of urgent cybersecurity reports today from Daily Security, CyberKendra, OSG, HTC, SentinelOne, VulnCheck, and the Tech and Editorial team.
That's a lot of reading.
It is. It is. But our mission today for you listening is to make sense of this freshly discovered, basically internet-breaking vulnerability, because today is Monday, June 29, 2026, and the public proof of concept exploit just dropped for a bug that, well, it literally flips the script on how we think about digital security.
It really is a complete inversion of reality for the cybersecurity world. I mean, we spent the last 30 years building taller walls around our servers.
Right, because the server is the vault.
Exactly. The entire industry is predicated on that idea. The server is the vault holding the valuable data, and the clients, so the laptops, the phones, the automated machines connecting to it, those are the untrusted entities that, might be malicious
Right,
actors.
they have to prove they belong there.
Yes, but this vulnerability forces us to look in the exact opposite direction. The vault is now attacking the customers.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are looking at a critical flaw designated as CVE 2026-5520.
Yeah.
And this flaw exists in a really foundational piece of internet infrastructure, right? A library called libs2.
Yeah, libs2. And to establish the gravity of the situation right up front, VulnCheck has actually rated this vulnerability with a CVSS 4.0 score of 9.2 out of 10.
Well, 9.2.
Yeah, which is massive. For anyone unfamiliar, CVSS is the Common Vulnerability Scoring System. It's the standardized framework the industry uses to rate how severe a bug
And
is.
anything above a 9 is pretty much in panic, right?
No. Oh, absolutely. Anything above a 9 is considered a critical, drop everything and fix it emergency. And the reason this is a 9.2 is precisely because of that role reversal we talked about. Because of this bug, malicious servers are now actively hunting the clients that connect to them.
Which is just wild to wrap your head around. You approach a server, assuming you're the one who has to prove your identity to prove your trustworthiness, but the server is the one actually setting the trap.
Exactly. It's lying in wait.
So, to really understand why a 9.2 severity rating is warranted here, I think we need to look at the timeline of a digital connection. Like, let's move from the concept of this inverted trust into the actual mechanics of a digital handshake. What is happening in those first few milliseconds when a client reaches out to a server?
Well, according to the findings from OSG HTC, this vulnerability triggers during the SSH transport processing phase.
Okay, transport processing. Break that down mechanically.
Sure. So, whenever your computer talks to a server using the SSH protocol secure shell, they perform this complex dance called a handshake. Your client reaches out and essentially says, hello, I'd like to connect.
And the server says hello back.
Right. The server responds with, hello, here's the version of the protocol I support. They negotiate how they're going to encrypt their communication, and then, and only then, after all of that foundational setup is done, they exchange credentials to prove who is who.
So that's the usernames, passwords, encryption keys, all of that.
Right. But this bug exploits a flaw in the very first few seconds of that initial setup.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it happens during the transport negotiation, which occurs way before any credentials are ever requested or exchanged.
Wait, so if I have like a 4096-bit SSH key, which is essentially the gold standard of modern encryption, and I've got, multi-factor authentication locked down on every single one of my accounts, does none of that matter?
None of it matters.
Yes.
Seriously, that is the zero authentication nightmare that's outlined in these reports. You don't need a username. You don't need a password. You don't need stolen SSH keys.
And MFA.
The attacker doesn't need to bypass your two-factor authentication to win either. The exact moment you execute and swish command and reach out to an untrusted server, the game is just over.
Because the infection happens before your computer even has a chance to offer its secure credentials.
Exactly. You're robbed before you show your ID.
Man. So if strong passwords and encryption keys can't save you, what is physically happening inside the machine to let the server take over? Like, how does the server actually infect the client computer?
Okay, so the vulnerability resides in a specific piece of code called the swesh2 transport head function.
Swesh to transport red.
Yeah, and this function has one singular job, which is to read and process incoming SSH packets of data from the server. Because when data travels across the internet, it isn't sent as one giant file, right? It's sliced up into tiny packets.
Right, like individual letters in the mail.
Exactly. And each packet has a header. Think of it like a shipping label that tells the receiving computer exactly how much data is inside.
Okay.
So the stash2transportread function is supposed to validate that the size of the data packet falls within acceptable, you know, safe limits before it opens the package.
So a malicious server starts sending data. What does it put on that shipping label to break the system?
The server sends a specially crafted SSH packet with a massive packet length value attached to it.
How massive are we talking?
We are talking about a value approaching 4 gigabytes of data in a single packet.
In one packet?
Yes. And the way the libshu software was written, like 15 years ago, the packet length field is defined using a 32-bit integer.
A 32-bit integer, meaning the computer's memory only allocates a very specific number of binary bits, ones and zeros, to store that number.
Yes, exactly. In computer science, a 32-bit integer has a hard mathematical limit. The absolute maximum number it can represent is roughly 4.2 billion.
Okay, so it literally can't count higher than that.
Right. So when the vulnerable client receives a number that approaches or exceeds that maximum capacity, the mathematical calculations trying to figure out how much memory buffer to allocate, they end up triggering an integer overflow.
Okay, I think I see where this is going.
To visualize it, think of an older car's mechanical odometer. As you drive, the numbers go up, you know, 999,997, 999,998.
And 999,999.
Right. But when you drive that next mile, it doesn't go to 1 million. It runs out of physical dials and rolls completely over right back to zero.
So what does this all mean for the computer then? The memory allocation math rolls over back to zero, or I guess a very small number. It's basically the system thinks it only needs a tiny cardboard box to store the incoming data.
That's a great way to look at it.
But in reality, it just got handed a massive shipping container of information. And because it only prepared a tiny cardboard box, that massive shipping container just crushes everything around it, taking over the computer.
Yes. That is the perfect way to visualize an out-of-bounds write. Because of that odometer rollover, the system allocates a tiny, entirely inadequate memory heap.
And then it tries to stuff the 4 gigabytes into it.
Exactly. It attempts to write massive amounts of incoming server data into that tiny space. The data overflows the intended boundary, spilling out and overwriting adjacent memory spaces on the computer.
Which is bad.
Very bad. This memory corruption is basically the holy grail for hackers because it allows the malicious server to achieve remote code execution, or RCE.
Meaning they can run whatever commands they want on your machine. They basically have the keyboard.
They completely own the system. Mm. From that point on, they can install ransomware, they can steal local files, or they can pivot deeper into your private network.
Okay, so having established how this tiny memory math bug completely destroys the system, we have to look at the real-world impact. Because reading through these reports, who is actually shaking hands with these malicious servers?
Right. That's the big question.
Right. It seems like the terrifying answer is that libshu is completely invisible to most users.
Mm.
Like, it's not an app you just click on your desktop.
No. It's a software library. It's a foundational building block that other developers use to build their applications.
So it's baked into other things.
Exactly. If we look at the GitHub advisory database and CyberKendra's reporting, libshu specifically, all versions up to and including 1.11.1, is silently embedded in millions of systems worldwide.
Millions.
Yeah. And system administrators often have no idea it's even running under the hood. For example, it's baked into many versions of CURL, which is the standard command line tool systems used to handle secure file transfers, known as SCP and SFTP.
SCP being Secure Copy Protocol, and SFTP being SC's file transfer protocol.
Correct. It is literally the plumbing of the internet. It's inside enterprise backup utilities that archive data at midnight. It's hard-coded into the firmware of countless IoT devices, smart cameras, industrial sensors, routers all across the planet.
See, here's where it gets really interesting to me. When you talk about enterprise backup utilities and IoT sensors, you're talking about machines talking to machines.
Yes.
So it seems like automated systems are the biggest victims here, not necessarily humans sitting at a keyboard typing out commands.
Oh, they are the primary targets, without a doubt. Think about a typical modern software company. They use automated DevOps environments called CI/CD pipelines, continuous integration, and continuous deployment.
Right.
Whenever a developer writes new code, they push it to a repository. Automatically, a build server spins up, reaches out over the internet using SSH to fetch the necessary files, compiles the code, tests it, and deploys it.
And it does that automatically.
Thousands of times a day.
Yeah.
Entirely without human oversight.
So there's no human sitting there looking at a screen to notice that a server's IP address looks slightly suspicious, or to question a weird security certificate warning. The machine just connects because it was programmed to connect.
Exactly. And instantly, the entire build infrastructure falls to the attacker. If you compromise a CI/CD pipeline, you don't just own one machine.
You own the whole factory.
You own the factory that produces the software. You can secretly inject malware into the company's official product before it even gets shipped to millions of customers.
Which makes the three specific attack scenarios outlined in the sources incredibly concerning. Because if attackers don't want to just sit around hoping an automated machine connects to them, how do they go on the offensive?
Right, they have methods.
Let's talk about the first scenario mentioned, SSH server honeypots.
Yeah, so in a honeypot scenario, the attacker sets up a fake malicious SSH server and masquerades as a legitimate service.
How do they trick the machines into connecting, though?
They might use type squatting, so registering a domain name that is just one letter off from a popular code repository like GitHub or GitLab. Or they might buy up expired IP addresses that old, forgotten automated scripts are still trying to connect to.
Oh, well, just catching the strays.
Exactly. The attacker just leaves the trap open. When an automated build server makes a typo or uses an outdated configuration, it reaches out to the honeypot and the server fires back that massive 4 gigabyte packet, taking over the client.
Man. And the second scenario is legitimate server compromise, which takes this a step further into a supply chain attack. How does that work mechanically?
This one is highly destructive. Let's say an attacker manages to exploit an unrelated vulnerability to breach a legitimate, trusted SSH server.
Like a hosting provider?
Yeah, perhaps a massive shared hosting provider where thousands of small businesses host their websites. Once the attacker controls that central server, they weaponize it with the libs2 exploit.
Oh, I see.
Now, every single time a web developer connects to manage their website or an automated backup script logs in to save the day's data, the trusted server silently infects them.
So one single breached server cascades into thousands of compromised clients.
Exactly. It's a supply chain nightmare.
That is a nightmare for system administrators.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third scenario listed is the classic man-in-the-middle attack. But how does an attacker actually pull off a man-in-the-middle exploit using a memory bug?
It relies on intercepting the traffic. So imagine a developer working from a local coffee shop on an insecure public Wi-Fi network.
Okay.
The attacker is sitting at the next table running a tool that poisons the local network routing. When the developer's laptop tries to connect to their company's secure server, the attacker intercepts that request.
So the laptop is talking to the guy at the next table.
Right. The developer thinks they're talking to their company, but they're actually talking to the attacker's machine. The attacker accesses the server, sends the malformed packet to overflow the client's memory, takes control of the developer's laptop, and then here's the kicker. They quietly forward the legitimate connection along to the real company server.
So the developer sees their terminal login successfully.
Yep.
They just do their work, completely oblivious to the fact that their machine was compromised in the first 3 seconds of the session.
Exactly. It is completely invisible to the end user.
Okay, let's talk about the timeline, because this is where things get truly tense. This library is 15 years old.
Yeah, a decade and a half.
It has been embedded everywhere for 15 years. Why is the cybersecurity world only panicking about this today, on June 29, 2026?
Because the timeline of this disclosure is incredibly compressed. The vulnerability was first discovered by researchers in early June 2026.
Just a few weeks ago.
Right. The official CVE announcement with that terrifying 9.2 rating was published on June 22. A patch was quietly released on June 25 in code commit 7S3DF.
Okay.
But today, June 29, a public proof of concept exploit video was dropped right into the wild.
A proof of concept, meaning someone published a blueprint showing exactly how to pull off the attack.
Yes.
And SentMalone confirmed this POC isn't just theoretical, right? Their analysis of the video shows a malicious server successfully using that oversized packet length to achieve remote code execution.
Exactly. The weapon works, and the blueprints are now available to literally any hacker with an internet connection.
Which is why the panic is happening today.
Right. And to give some historical context, this isn't the first time researchers have found memory issues in this code.
Oh, really?
Yeah, back in 2019, the GitHub Security Lab found similar integer overflows in this exact library, for example. CVE-2019-1314-PIN, which was an 8.1 severity server-to-client bug.
Okay, an 8.1.
But this new bug, CVE-2026-55200, is exponentially worse. It triggers much earlier in the transport layer, requiring absolutely zero authentication, and now it has a live PC. Voncheck is ranking the severity of this right up there, with industry-defining incidents like Heartbleed, which scored a 7.5, and Log4Shell, which was a 10.0.
Wait, I want to push back on that comparison for a second. If Log4Shell was a perfect 10 out of 10, this is a 9.2.
No.
Why are researchers treating this like it's just as bad? Is it really on the same catastrophic level?
It's an important distinction to make. Log4Shell was a 10 because of its sheer scope. It allowed clients to attack servers.
Which casts a much wider net.
Exactly. That casts a massively wide net across the public internet because servers are literally designed to listen to anyone. Anyone could send a simple string of text to a public server and take it over.
Right.
But this bug is a 9.2 because the attack direction is inverted servers attacking clients, means the client has to actively initiate the connection first. That limits the scope slightly.
Okay, that makes sense. But then why is it still considered catastrophic?
Because of the depth of the structural damage. It fundamentally breaks the automated infrastructure of the internet. When your CI/CD pipelines, your automated backup routines, and your fleet of millions of IoT devices are the targets, you're looking at a massive, incredibly complex supply chain cleanup.
Because you have to hunt down embedded libraries across millions of devices that don't even have screens to log into.
Exactly.
And Taken's analysis points at a really unsettling fact. This bug hid in open source, peer-reviewed code for 15 years. How does a bug this bad survive a decade and a half of security audits?
Well, because during normal day-to-day operation, the code behaves perfectly. Normal SSH connections never send packets anywhere near 4 gigabytes in size.
Not even close.
Right. Standard software testing missed it entirely because testers only check if the software handles expected behavior correctly. It took a technique called advanced fuzzing to finally find it.
Fuzzing being the process of throwing massive amounts of randomized, deliberately malformed garbage data at a program just to see what makes it crash.
Yes. Security researchers used fuzzers to bombard the libs2 library with millions of unexpected packet sizes until they finally hit the exact integer overflow condition.
Wow.
It underscores how insidious these foundational bugs are. They lie dormant until deliberately provoked by someone who knows exactly where to push.
So, with a live weapon in the wild right now, we need to pivot from understanding the threat to surviving it. What does the listener need to do today? Let's walk through the survival guide outlined by the researchers.
Okay, the immediate action plan starts with visibility. You cannot fix what you cannot see. System administrators need to find out right now if they are running libs2 version 1, pick un or lower.
How do they check that?
If you're on a Linux system, you can open your terminal and run the command ldconfig -b grep libs2. You can also use the ALLETE command on data transfer tools like curl to see if they dynamically link to the vulnerable library.
And if they run those commands and find the vulnerable version?
Update immediately to version 1.11.2 or higher. That is the only true fix.
What if they can't?
Right. If you are in a massive enterprise production environment where you cannot immediately patch thousands of machines, you need to implement strict network controls. Restrict outbound SSH connections so that your automated systems can only communicate with known trusted servers.
That makes sense.
And for advanced environments, consider deploying an SSH proxy that intercepts, filters, and inspects all connections to ensure no 4 gigabyte packets are trying to sneak through.
Let's talk about worst case scenarios. What if a listener discovers their automated backup system has been connecting to a suspicious server for the last 3 days?
You have to assume full compromise. Standard incident response applies, but you must be rigorous. Immediately sever the compromised system's connection to the network.
Disconnect it entirely.
Yes. Revoke all SSH keys, passwords, and stored credentials. Just assume the attacker has already stolen them. Perform a thorough forensic analysis to determine if the attacker pivoted to other machines, and then you must wipe the machine entirely.
Burn it to the ground.
Rebuild the system from a clean, known good backup that predates the compromise and ensure the new build deploys with the patched version of the library.
Now, I want to make one crucial clarification here that jumped out from the OSG HTC report, because I know people are going to hear SSH vulnerability and immediately panic about their basic server setups. OpenSSH is not vulnerable, correct?
Yeah, that is correct, and it is a vital distinction to make. OpenSSH, which is the standard software most people use when they open a terminal and type search, does not rely on the libstu library.
Okay, good.
It was written using its own independent implementation of the SSH protocol. So if you are just using standard OpenSSH, you are insulated from this specific bug. But remember, your overarching operating system might still have libstu installed in the background for other automated tools, so checking your systems is still mandatory.
Okay, let me play the role of the everyday remote worker here for a second. What if I just use a VPN? Doesn't a virtual private network encrypt and protect my internet traffic from these kinds of network attacks?
That raises a really important question about how different security layers interact, and it's a very common misconception. The short answer is absolutely not. A VPN will not protect you from this in any way.
Wait, why not? If the traffic is encrypted in a tunnel, how can the server infect the client?
Because of where the vulnerability exists. In computer networking, we separate functions into different layers. A VPN operates at the network layer. Its job is to provide a secure, encrypted tunnel from your laptop to another point on the internet, ensuring nobody on the outside can read the traffic. But this SSH vulnerability exists at the application layer. It's a flaw in the actual data being sent inside the tunnel.
Oh, I see.
If you use a VPN to intentionally connect to a malicious SSH server, the VPN just did its job flawlessly. It delivered your data securely right into the attacker's trap.
Right.
The malicious server still sends the malformed packet back through your secure tunnel, your client still overflows its memory integer, and your machine is still compromised. A perfectly secure tunnel to a bomb is still a bomb.
Wow. A secure tunnel to a bomb is still a bomb. That perfectly distills why this is so dangerous.
Looking at the big picture of everything we've discussed today, we really are witnessing a paradigm shift in how we architect cybersecurity.
We really are. Every firewall, every intrusion detection system, every piece of zero trust architecture has been fundamentally built around the assumption that the server is the victim and the client is the threat. Overnight, we have to re-engineer our defenses to protect our clients from the very servers they are designed to communicate with.
It challenges our most deeply held trust assumptions. The tech and editorial team put it perfectly in their analysis. Security is a journey, not a destination. Mm-hmm. We have this 15-year-old open source, extensively battle-tested protocol, and it still requires constant vigilance and advanced fuzzing to keep it safe. There is no finish line. We are never truly done securing the internet.
Which leaves you with something fascinating to think about. If a 15-year-old foundational library can harbor a mathematical error that completely reverses our concept of who attacks whom, what other invisible building blocks of the internet are silently waiting to flip our reality upside down tomorrow? What if the next great inversion isn't in how we communicate, but in how we store our data?
That is exactly the kind of critical question security teams need to be asking as they review their architecture tomorrow morning.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Please go check your automated systems, run those visibility commands, and update your libraries immediately. Stay safe out there.